Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, we speak to Marie, an adult transracial adoptee advocate, and she shares her experience of growing up, her views on adoption, and the work that she undertakes with the Intercountry Adoptee Voices organisation. Marie discusses the challenges that are faced in relation to identity, belonging, and wider underlying issues around adoption in this honest conversation. We hope you find it enlightening, and as always, if you've experience of adoption, fostering, or special guardianship from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch. You can do that through either the Facebook page, Twitter page, or email us at the aandfpodcast@gmail.com.
My name is Marie Gardam. I was born Marie Geraldine Lam in Malaysia. I'm Chinese and Indian. My mother was Indian and my father Chinese. And I was adopted there. I was born in a home for unmarried mothers. So that gives you an indication of why I was adopted. And probably being mixed race is another factor in that too. My adoptive parents were stationed in Malaysia because my dad was in the Air Force. So they were there living this colonial life. Now, there's another factor. And they were infertile, so they were looking to adopt. I was 2 months old when I was adopted, and then I was 7 months old when they moved back to the UK. And because my dad was in the forces, it also meant that we moved around a lot. So I spent half of my childhood, I would say, in Germany, but we kind of moved back and forth between England, Scotland, Wales, Germany, back to UK and back to Germany. And I came back to the UK when I was 20 with my adoptive family. That was an incredibly lonely lifestyle for me as an adoptee, moving around and being the only person of colour, really, for most of our community. I can name one or two maybe that existed, but not Chinese or Indian really for most of the time. And in terms of adoptees, I met one other adoptee who kind of told me they were adopted. I'm sure you can meet them all the time, but they don't necessarily share that with you if they don't know that you're adopted. When I was about 12, I discovered that one of my kind of distant school friends was an adoptee, but she kind of closed down about that very quickly. So we didn't talk about it. And beyond that, I haven't really talked to other adoptees until I was in my 40s in the last few years. And that happened after Brexit happened. And my parents and I have always had a pretty fractious relationship since I got into my teens and we moved again to Germany. And that really kind of threw things into the mix for me. And I knew a lot of it was about my adoption. I was feeling lonely and isolated and rootless because of the lifestyle that we had. But I don't think my parents knew that this discussion was about adoption because I didn't say it and I don't think it occurred to them. But we kind of got through, we muddled through. we've never been very alike in any way at all. But they love me. They love me the way that they would love anyone, you know. But that's not necessarily the way I needed to be loved because I was different from them. My life was different and my experiences were different. But then when Brexit happened and my parents voted Brexit, everything got shaken apart for me. All of the things that were layered already just threw me into a whirlwind because I realized, you know, I had to tell them, you know, I'm an Asian immigrant. You know, and this is largely, there's a lot of anti-immigration within the Brexit kind of conversation. And they were Daily Express readers. So a lot of what they were hearing about Brexit was also rooted in immigrant conversation. And I had to tell them I'm an Asian immigrant. And my mom kind of looked at me and said, oh, we've never thought of you that way. You know, and I kind of realized through that beginning of the conversation and then through the constellated conversations I was having with friends and other people that they just don't see me as Asian. And they don't see me as immigrant. And they think that's a compliment rather than it being a complete erasure of an identity that I hold for myself. And it was just very difficult to have those conversations with my parents until eventually these other things are happening with Trump, with Charlottesville, with all these key conversations happening in the media. And their kind of Daily Express headline would be there in their house when I would visit. You know, these anti-immigrant headlines would be there. And they didn't really think about it. It wasn't on their consciousness that that was offensive, I don't think. But for me, it shook everything apart. And one of my friends said to me, why don't you speak to our friend who's adopted? And I kind of shrugged and went, yeah, all right. I didn't really think that was going to be, even though I knew it was kind of some adoption issues there, I didn't really think it was going to change the game the way that it did. She's a white adoptee. But in that conversation, you know, just having someone say, oh yeah, that's an adoptee thing. You know, and in my head, I'm kind of thinking, well, yeah, of course it is, but no one's ever said that to me before. Nobody's ever just recognized that. And that's where I went looking for adoptee community after that and found not only an adoptee community, but transracial adoptee community. I discovered that word transracial. I'd never heard it before until, you know, 46 or so. And that there was some names for my experience, that it wasn't just in my head, that there was actually some language around it, basic language, but it exists, and a community of people that have experienced so many overlapping things that it changed everything for me, and that validated a lot of my experience. And since then, I now work, I'm a coach, but I also work voluntarily. I'm on the board with ICAV, which is Intercountry Adoptee Voices, and I represent ICAV in the UK, and we have a growing group of interracial and transracial and intercountry adoptees within the group. And I now advocate as much as possible. But it can be difficult because the dynamic between what I say in public and what might get to my parents, that's tricky. So I've had to do that somewhat anonymously in the beginning, and I'm starting to do that less so now. My dad died at Christmas, and when it happened, we were estranged because of the difficulties we'd had. So many layers of difficulty around trying to have these conversations with parents who have not been prepared for them.
I mean, there's it sounds like you've condensed a long story there. And it sounds like, incredibly raw even still. And sometimes people see adoption as this event, this happened to this little girl,
yeah,
when she was 2 months old.
It was over then, and then everything started. Yeah, but it's a lifelong event. And just witnessing my own experience and other people's experience in our community, there are particular milestones that will set off just new perspectives for us. For many adoptees, it's having their own children, giving birth to their own children, and they realize, wow, this is not what I've been told, kind of thing, you know, that anyone could give away a baby. You know, their experience of that is just shifted. And then it might be an event like myself, where another identity shifting event, reality kind of changes, where you realize how you've been operating in the world has been separate for other people. They haven't been identifying you in the same way.
There was a really interesting phrase that you said. You said you talked about the erasure of the identity you saw of yourself. And has that been was that how you saw yourself very clear, and how they saw you? Was there just such a big disparity between the two?
Yeah, I kind of never felt, until the last few years, I never really thought I had to point out that I'm Asian. I thought that was palpably obvious. You know, maybe not the details of what my ethnicity is, but that I am Asian. And certainly to the people who know me and who do know that. But somehow, you know, even with some friends now, I might have to correct them and say, no, I'm Asian. And they will say, oh, but you're British, you know, and that's their version of kind of, yeah. And I think it's genuinely meant to be inclusive rather than to be erasing. But yeah, it just really shows me that my reality and theirs is just completely different, and that they're not even aware of what I would call white supremacy, you know, that this version that you know, in their heads, I'm one of them and therefore I'm white and that's a good thing, you know. It's complicated because my identity as being Asian in a very general way is very clear, but my identity beyond that, it's not granular because I haven't had any access to my culture at all. I haven't even grown up with any Chinese or Indian people in my life. And I still don't really have Chinese or Indian people in my life, a little bit, but not in my close circle. So what it means to be those things is vague and unclear and difficult, because seeking out that kind of knowledge from adulthood is not the same as being raised from it. You know, there's all kinds of gatekeeping that happens, which is very difficult for an adoptee to, for me as an adoptee to not feel the rejection of it.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Are you seen as a curiosity, or are you seen as another by the people from that community? Do they look at you and sort of?
I feel kind of invisible to them a lot of the time. So yeah, in the last few years, I went along to a Buddhist temple, an event that was happening in a Buddhist temple in London with some friends, and so I'm surrounded by Chinese people and they're talking Mandarin, I think, and I feel like nobody is kind of recognizing me as being Chinese in any way, that like I'm invisible to them in terms of not being one of them. Yeah, that's particularly the case with my Chinese side, I think, because that's particularly not visible in my looks. Indian, I think sometimes people get there, but most often people guess me as being something like South American, actually. So a lot of the time, there's a lot of ambiguity about what I look like and a lot of questions.
And that's a really arbitrary way of... and also looking at you and going, well, you must be this, because actually what's going on inside is much more complicated, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Where you mm-hmm. belong.
Yeah, belonging is the key point. I just don't think... Yeah, I don't think it's ever possible... For me, I'm not speaking for all adoptees, but I can't see myself feeling a sense of belonging within any particular community of Chinese or Indian or even Malaysian, and not even in Britain either, because my lifestyle didn't. Other adoptees are probably raised more with more solid base than me, but I was moving around so much that I didn't identify strongly as being British, and my sense of being othered a lot made me kind of not want to claim that identity for myself either.
You've painted quite a damning picture of transracial adoption.
I have. Yeah. I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan.
On balance.
Okay.
How do you look at the, I mean, what are your perspectives on it? Because it still occurs, you know, it still does happen.
Yeah.
Looking into that from your perspective, what are your thoughts on, there's a whole raft of things about your own experience that you can have really good and insightful kind of views on. So what do you think?
I see adoption in general as being not so much childcare as a redaction of identity. I don't think it's a necessary part of looking after children. I prefer models like guardianship or kinship care, whereby people, first of all, family reunion, reunification would be my first preference. So there's a real effort to make sure that this family isn't being separated by poverty or by patriarchy or by child trafficking, or, you know, that certain things are definitely not in play in this adoption, first of all. And then secondly, that if all of that is not a part of it and it's really needs to happen, then that their identity is not taken from them, that they still have family connection, that they still have access to siblings and parents if it's safe to, and aunts and uncles and grandpas and their culture. The access is still there and freely given, an effort made to really make those connections. that it's really purely in the interests of the child and not considering the interests of the parents, which I see happening more often, that it's more about parents looking to build their families than it's about children who need protection or care. That's the way I see it happening. It feels like it's becoming a reproductive rights issue for people who want to build families rather than people who got families and are struggling to hold them together. Does that answer your question?
It does, yeah. I'm conscious that, you know, I speak to a lot of people who've been adopted, and they find that their views stand in opposition to their parents' actions.
Mm-hmm.
Which must be difficult. Is that an open conversation? Because sometimes parents have revelations, don't they?
Yeah. No, that's been one of the most difficult things for me, is what feels like playing pretend. I'm not someone who plays pretend in life generally, or certainly not outside my adoptive home, but at home it feels like very much my real self is invisible to them, because like I said, they already don't really see me as Chinese Indian or Malaysian. When I say it, you can kind of see their minds freeze. They've never denied it. They've never actually said, no, you're not. But there's a sort of brain freeze that happens when I talk about that identity, if I do, which has only really happened in fights about racism. So it's not been a kind of natural, organic part of our conversation growing up as a family. I don't see them ever having identified us as a multiracial family. I don't think they view us that way. I think they view us as a white family, and you know, then there's me. You know, I don't think they've ever made that jump in their head that we are a multiracial family. That's all of us. My presence in this house makes it that way. And yeah, we've never really talked about it. And so because I am a different race, it's, you know, they have had to tell me I was adopted from an early age, and that's been, you know, a part of the conversation to a degree, but never more nuanced conversation about it beyond. So for example, just knowing why was I adopted? The answer was, your mother wasn't married, you know, and that in itself, when you're a child, you don't have the detective skills or the journalistic skills to interrogate that. But now I'm thinking, wow, the fact that people can say that or hear that, you know, if I say that to someone because they ask me why, and that the answer is good enough to them, is a really complicated thing for me to make sense of, that that doesn't seem like that's a justice, social justice issue to you. And the same applies to things like, because they couldn't afford the healthcare because this child needed additional operations or whatever, which is more the case in somewhere like America than here. But here it might be a low-income family who are struggling to get childcare, and you know, so neglect might have been a part of the play, but really poverty is behind that, you know. And yeah, people kind of accept those inequalities very quickly without really seeming to sympathize with our first families or considering it a social justice issue at all. And that's very difficult. It's really difficult.
So is this, I mean, you talked about it coming to a head, maybe the wrong word, but a head post-Brexit. But what's this stuff that's sort of been just ruminating for years?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, when we moved from Lincoln to Germany, I was 15, and I just started to make friends and just started to kind of build some relationships that were really crucial to me. And that was a falling out point between me and my parents. At that point, I really blamed my dad in particular for kind of his job prioritized over me, which, you know, now as an adult, I can allow for a bit more complexity about that. But certainly at that point, I blamed him for not really caring about what it meant to me. And like I said, we didn't talk about adoption in that way, that it was even harder for me to form strong relationships as an adoptee. I was already rootless through adoption. And then my roots were being kind of pulled up constantly and moved somewhere. So that was a rupture for us as a family. And it didn't really heal properly. There was just a kind of thin layer over top of it. You know, I remember my husband constantly, when we would go to visit, my husband would kind of say, you love your family. You know, there would be this little preparation to try and ward off some of the conflicts that would happen. Yeah, so there were ruptures that were there all along, but we kind of tried to manage as a family in particular. Yeah, from their side, I think that there was almost nothing wrong from their side. I think that they kind of put it down to moodiness or whatever. They didn't really think that there was something complex wrong, I don't think. So after I just couldn't keep going like this, and I said, we can't not talk about race and racism and adoption anymore. And it kind of turned into an estrangement. They were completely shocked and surprised by that. From their perspective, they really didn't see it coming.
Which, I mean, it's not my job to unpick your family, right? So I'm not going to even go there. it seems to be a common theme, is where perhaps adoptive parents, as it can speak as one, sometimes we're just not necessarily conscious of the inner world of our children.
Yeah, I think that if there's one thing I would really love for adoptive parents to think about and hear, it's that no child and very few adults have the emotional literacy to talk about what's happened to us, to talk about something that's happened to us and probably almost no one around us. So the people around us don't have language for it because they don't have to explain it. It hasn't happened to them, and it's very difficult for them to put themselves in your shoes. So for us as children to have the language to explain how we're feeling and even notice that something is different and to kind of name it, that's really difficult for us to do. And it's difficult for us to do as adults, let alone children. Mm. And so I see how that kind of adds to a layer of mythology, I think, that exists already in adoption land. People building families want to believe this is just the same as any other family, and that no pain has been, the pain was before the adoption, not after or because of, you know, that's the kind of the fantasy, which I completely understand why that's the case. I really encourage people to confront it though, if you're an adoptive parent or if you're thinking about it, because yeah, talking about healing your own wounds is crucial to being able to really have open and candid conversations with anyone, let alone your children. But it's such a difficult thing to describe. It's such a lately I've been trying to work out ways to even get people to put themselves in my shoes, and the closest I've come is just imagine you as a little white baby, if you're a white person. Imagine that you were adopted by an Indian couple and taken to India, and you're being dressed up in the traditional clothing of that culture, and you're the only white baby in your culture. You're the only white baby around for miles. And if there are any role models, they're in the low income kind of jobs, and people laugh at them, and you know, generally they're not the favorite people. They're not in magazines. Yeah. That's the closest I can come to inviting people to feel what it would feel like. And it's not nearly close enough, but it's the closest I can come.
But that's a potent image. If you've got any sense of imagination, you can get 1% of your experience, can't you, from that, which is potent.
I hope so.
Yeah. So now you work, you support transracial adoptees, and you know, you've got a website, and we'll put all of the links in there. Doodly doodly. Okay. And so what is your, you know, from this sort of very personal place, what is your bigger aspiration really in relation to that?
My biggest aspiration, I would say, is to make sure that adoptees are an equal voice at the table when it comes to policy making and decision. Equal. Or if not even equal, more than the majority voice rather than the minority voice at the table. At the moment, it's very discounted. It's very paternalistic in terms of listening to adoptees. It feels very curated. If there are adoptees at the table, they're very curated voices who make everyone very comfortable and tell them adoption is beautiful. And those adoptees exist. I would say maybe cynically that they're just at a different stage in their thinking process, or yeah, they just have different kinds of attachments to their families that feel at risk if they are to talk in a different way. So it's a difficult thing to talk about this while your parents are living in the public arena. It's very difficult. And there's often a demand on you to express gratitude or love for your parents while you're doing it, which I'm relatively immune to, but I see it's very difficult for other adoptees, for many adoptees to do that. Having a voice at the table, and ICAV, the organization I work with, which was founded by Linnell Long 20 years ago or so, they are involved more and more in policy. They sit within the Hague Working Group every year and raise adoptee voices within that. But we are a minority voice at those tables, and we can be easily discounted and dismissed. But I do see a movement happening, many movements happening, which intersect with us as adoptees and are helping. I think they are helping to raise awareness that own voices are the important voices at the table. The lived experiences of adoptees are the ones we need to be listening to. I think that's still a difficult thing for anyone in the business to comprehend. I don't feel it's completely arms around that idea. I feel an awareness of it, but not a full embrace of it. What do you think?
Oh, it's not about me. Crikey, you got me on the ropes now. I think that it's complicated, like you said, to hear voices of people who've been adopted. And there's no one voice. That's part of the challenge. There is no one definitive voice. Mm-hmm. And that makes it easier to discount any voice. Because people can then say, oh, you're only speaking for them or them. Regardless of where you stand, you can always be accused of not speaking for everyone. I think that, you talked about like this patriarchy and the system that can't, just isn't what, it's just so alien to actually get people who've experienced adoption to air their views in a way that they can accept. I think it's just really difficult. It's not wired that way. You're having to turn the super tanker around.
Yeah, it's very systemic. Yeah. And so many overlapping biases as well. I mean, I'm going to get your bingo card out because I'm going to name them. I'm going to name them now. But within adoption, you've got patriarchy, you've got colonialism, you've got ableism, and you've got misogyny. You know, they're all kind of intertwined. Classism is the last one. Poverty is really kind of at the center of a lot of why families are separated. And then if you add other points of contact around single women, not happening so much in the UK, but certainly in inter-country adoption, that's still a huge issue from Korea or China or other areas of the world where that continues to be a difficulty for women alone raising a child. And those are all systemic issues that, like you say, they're baked into the process and people's unconscious bias about it. They're really not aware of it. You know, you'll hear that phrase better life a lot when it comes to adoption, and it's so layered with bias, but it's coded, so nobody has to really think about what they mean when they say it.
Yeah, I mean, you're the guest. I'm just here to ask the questions, so I'm not going to answer anymore because I get enough flack for talking too much. So you mentioned the work that you do with the ICAV. Is there a support element to that work as well? Mutual support, peer support?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a community piece. Probably in the UK in particular, primarily support at this point, because we're not yet having conversations in organizations who deal with adoption. Primarily, and I think it's the first stage in any movement really, is to come together as a community and support each other, validate each other, bear witness to what we've all experienced, give language to what we've experienced, and compare notes and start kind of, even if it's just intuitively, we're kind of gathering data and information about, yeah, what's really been happening on a larger scale. It's one thing to know your own experience, but then to start comparing notes and realizing, oh yeah, there are big themes here. There are big systemic issues at play. So yes, it's largely support. And then beyond that, we increasingly want to stop just kind of being in a bubble talking to each other and start to branch out beyond that, which parts of ICAB around the world are doing very successfully. But here in the UK, we're kind of early stages around that. We have a quite different culture, it feels like, around adoption in the UK. There's a lot of, oh, we don't need to worry because that doesn't happen here. There's a lot of that kind of thing. And then there's just not, it doesn't feel like our adoptee community is quite mobilized. Kind of, they haven't really found each other yet. It's quite small groups of adoptees who are talking. It just feels culturally quite different to other, even neighboring European countries where there's a lot of conversation happening beyond the community and things happening, like in the Netherlands, where inter-country adoptions have been halted there. And those conversations are happening also in Sweden and Germany and beyond as well. But not happening here.
I think the issue of culture is really interesting, and also that it's not like that here is really, you'd said it and I'd never heard it. I don't think I've ever heard it explicitly said, but it's been really clear. That's the message.
That it's not a problem here. Both racism and adoption issues, things are not happening here.
None of that. Wow. You've really given me loads to think about in relation to, all of it really, about race, racism, adoption, but you know, the whole international adoption, everything. Is there any questions that I haven't asked you that you were hoping I would ask?
One thing I wanted to talk about around the UK kind of difference as well is just this difference between how we seem to talk about inter-country adoption versus domestic adoption. Inter-country adoption doesn't get talked about that much at all. And there's maybe a sense that it's not happening that much. And I'm not sure if that's true or not. But certainly some rights have begun to come into play for adoptees in the UK where they have access to their records at 18. I don't think that's everyone, because I'm an inter-country adoptee. I don't see the details of how that plays out, but it feels like not everyone has access, but certainly most people or more people have access to their information once they hit 18. For me, that's not early enough, but at least at some point they will have access. But we're still participating in inter-country adoption where that's not mandated in any way, and we're still allowing veils of secrecy and corruption to take place under the guise of, you know, looking after children. I just think there's a dissonance there that isn't being discussed, that we'll allow things from other countries and these children to be treated a certain way from other countries that we're beginning to explore not doing in our own countries. And in fact, for a long time, we haven't done it that way in this country. I still think there's a long way to go around how adoptees are treated here. But for inter-country adoptees, we're way behind. There's no support for getting the same kind of treatment. I just want to open up the conversation around that, really, and have it recognized and discussed.
Are you an activist?
Yeah.
Cool. There you go. Marie, it's been loads of food for thought there, really, about just your perspective and your own experiences is very provocative, but also your perspectives drawing on a wider, you know, international perspective is really interesting. So thank you so much for giving me your time and sharing with us, and hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be able to talk to an audience beyond our adoptee community. So, and I'm happy that people are listening to that. So thank you to those listening as well.
Thank you.